Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 65, section 5, which is old single column, page 736. Okay, let's just recall briefly where we left off. Big picture, right? Over control of evolution, where we're considering most fundamentally the top-down vantage point on evolution. Mind is the immediate over-controller of that biologic evolution. We're thinking about, looking at that mind reaching down and engaging that life-animated material system, properly designed material system, and fostering it both to adapt horizontally and to progress vertically. And as they finished up section 4, if you were here in the preceding session, recall that they were reminding us of what they did as life carriers in modifying what's normal for this life experiment world. And for instance, that final paragraph of section 4, like they say there towards the end, many of these seemingly strange byproducts of our efforts are certain to meet your gaze. How they were pointing out that because of the way they loosened the constraints on the biologic system, mind engaging that system had a lot more avenues of possibility than what's normal. And so there were a number of curious tangents and means to a familiar end, but an unfamiliar means to a familiar end. You could say there was a lot of, would you look at that aspect to it because of the design. This next section is, they've mentioned the vicissitudes there in the title of this next section. Separate from those issues of new avenues because of the design is just the usual unexpected nature of things in all sorts of different ways when they initiate life on a planet. I think we mentioned, as we talked about that some, that they have to design for all kinds of possibilities to crop up that they aren't necessarily specifically anticipating. They have to design for a lot of eventualities. It's always a bit of a surprise. I mean, one of the things they're doing, recall, with the life experiment world is testing where the Supreme is now. The Supreme is going to take slightly different approaches than it did, a few hundred million years ago or whatever, when they did it before. And then, see, on top of it, you combine the two. You obviously, if you loosen the constraints, some of the normal vicissitudes will be a lot more consequential than the run-of-the-mill vicissitudes. Okay, so that's how you transition into this next section here. So let's just start out. You've got a little paragraph there to begin with the biggie that we all think of in terms of the vicissitudes that cropped up on this planet that don't have anything immediately to do with the biology or the mind engagement at all. But let's see what they say here.
Number five, life evolution vicissitudes. It was a source of regret to the life carriers that our special efforts to modify intelligent life on Urantia should have been so handicapped by tragic perversions beyond our control, the Caligastia betrayal and the Adamic default.
Okay, so besides the civilizational consequences of the rebellion and the default, what's between the lines of that relative to the biologic evolution? Part of their plan was to make up for all of the potentially even greater vicissitudes than normal, especially with the Adamic uplift, the Adamic guidance of blending the races. Maybe it's going to be a little bit trickier than normal, but they're going to do it very well. They're going to take a long-term view. They're going to do it well. They're going to get them properly blended. They're going to get them properly uplifted. And when all is said and done, that should make up for just about any, relatively extreme vicissitude that might crop up on this world. Right, so that's obviously the upfront statement they have to make. It's like, okay, so all of those plans just got blown up. And it's no minor issue. I mean, it was a fundamental part of their plan. So they use a strong word there, right, for beings that are supposed to be taking, very objective, long-term view, regret. We all know about that, our not wanting our attitude to consist so largely of regretting the past, whining over the present, and vainly hoping for the future, right? But it's inescapable. There's something that huge is going to lead to a response in the life carriers, just like it would lead to in us, regret. So they don't use that word lightly. As the life carriers admit, they have to just trust. I mean, they really don't know how this is going to work out. It's a deep, abiding, lasting regret, that they can't see through yet, and they just have to just let go of it as best they can by trusting. So it's a between the lines is a lesson for us. That this is something that we have to try to challenge ourselves to do. We're not alone. Many celestials struggle with this same issue of regret relative to a past event. The best laid plans of mice and life carriers, in this case, right? Note that very strong word that's there. And so that's the predicate. And then they burrow in on the specifics here. So what's one of the biggies? They've mentioned it before. They're going to mention it again here.
But throughout all of this biologic adventure, our greatest disappointment grew out of the reversion of certain primitive plant life to the pre-chlorophyll levels of parasitic bacteria on such an extensive and unexpected scale. This eventuality in plant life evolution caused many distressful diseases in the higher mammals, particularly in the more vulnerable human species. When we were confronted with this perplexing situation, we somewhat discounted the difficulties involved because we knew that the subsequent admixture of the Adamic life plasm would so reinforce the resisting powers of the resulting blended race as to make it practically immune to all diseases produced by the vegetable type of organism. But our hopes were doomed to disappointment owing to the misfortune of the Adamic default.
Yeah, so there's we have disappointment in the beginning of the paragraph. We have disappointment at the end of the paragraph. We have doomed. Don't underestimate a word like misfortune. You know, that prefix there, there's a wrongly. They're talking about how disruptive to conformity with the cosmos in a very holistic way this problem is. Again, you know, they know all of these sophisticated details about how through this long, complex process will creatures come about who have the potential of righteousness, the potential of conformity with the cosmos. And that was thrown into serious disarray, okay? By this, remember how they talked about it before, the majority of disease-causing bacteria and their auxiliary virus bodies really belong to this group of renegade parasitic fungi, right? The renegades, the word again, remember how I pointed out, notice that word, how strong a word that is. So we've got this difficult issue of this retrograde phenomenon. And they'll bring it up yet again here as we continue forward. It's such a huge issue that you're going to this pre-chlorophyll, and you're going, well, wait a minute, weren't the first, they put these single-celled eukaryotic plants, right, these algae, single-celled algae, in the shallow seas. I mean, there's chlorophyll there, isn't there? What do they mean by pre-chlorophyll level? They're doing a little bit of shorthand there. They mentioned it specifically before, and they'll be more specific again when they bring it up again. Before, see, it said they lost their chlorophyll making ability. So that if those chlorophyll molecules are lost, there's no way for them to be regenerated by some internal, biogenesis process, some internal process within the organism to reconstruct those chlorophyll molecules. And so that's what they're getting at is, it's one thing to have something that's like it's got them and it can use them, but then if it can't make new ones, if for some reason they're destroyed or damaged or something, right? So that's the deal there. So you'll see what they mean a little more specifically by the pre when we get to this section 6. Let me bring it up again. Let's see. Anything else there? Stressing again, like they did before, to appreciate how, again, why they would use such strong language. It's the type of assault, this vegetable type of organism, as I stress there again. You have this assault on the very foundation of foundations of your nature. I mean, yes, you have designs on being this righteous personal self of spiritualized mind, conforming with the cosmos of universal harmony and all these things. Okay, but that's all predicated on, that human, that personal self is predicated on an animal origin self, which is predicated on a plant self. Right? And so when you have things that are attacking that foundation, and again, you'll see how they'll bring that up some in the next section, there's you know, there's a very strong tendency that you'll have a collapsing cascade effect. I mean, you knock the bottom brick out, and everything just falls down into the hole. Right? Now, so that's why these are, you know, these diseases are so, as they say, distressful. You know, that's how they say, many distressful diseases. See, they just, because they knock the foundation out, and it's hard to have any sort of a properly formed mind upon such a broken foundation. And, you know, obviously your relationship to spirit and your personal nature are then lost. It all can collapse. Okay.
So it sounds like, you know, that this is happening in the higher mammals and the humans. It almost makes it sound like that it wasn't happening in the lower mammals as much. And I'm wondering why, when I read this, I read it a number of times.
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you have any comment on that or what you're thinking about
what they're trying to infer here? That's what I was just speaking to. I could have stressed that. See, when they say many distressful diseases in the higher mammals, particularly in the more vulnerable human species, you can see, what's the vulnerability? I mean, it's like, isn't my basic, say, reptile nature, you know, like the reptiles themselves? Yeah. See, but again, the higher you build this structure, right, the more delicate it gets on the top. And the more fragile it is to any disruption of the base. I mean, an actual reptile has no delicate structure upon its foundation.
This is biologic, though, right?
We're talking about a biologic foundation. But remember, all of your mind is predicated on that biologic foundation. None of your mind can just float there all wonderfully, right? It's seated upon your biologic foundation very intimately.
Why would a non-chloroform bacteria have, as you say, more of an effect on a higher species?
Well, no, it's just that it's parasitic. You know, it's attacking you. It's trying. It's, you know, I mean, it's literally, you know, going to use you as an energy source,
okay,
instead of the sun.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, we all know what diseases do. I mean, they just, you know, right. See, it's because it's literally sucking the energy out of you. And it has such a cataclysmic effect, like I'm saying, rather than you just kind of like slowing down. It's like, boy, it's like I need to eat more or something. It's not just you're losing energy in merely that way. You see, it's literally, you know, knocking the foundation out of a very delicate mind functioning on top. You very quickly notice it's hard to think, you know, in a more human, objective way. And everything just, you know, goes downhill from there. I mean, that's what they mean by, that's why they're stressing the higher mammals. The mammals that are trying to have the higher adjutants seated on them, and those adjutants are sensitive. The higher the adjutant, the more sensitive to the foundation, you know, to disruptions in the foundation.
So it does seem like, you know, a lot of animals don't get sick like we do. Similar kinds of diseases of the lower kinds. You thinking that has to do with that whole combination there? That's just interesting theory.
So another way to think about it is what I was just saying. Instead of thinking about it in this vertical stack mode that I was just trying to analogize in, think more holistically. Technically, you know, you don't literally have delicate top pieces and robust bottom pieces, you know, like that analogy seems to indicate. In order for you to have a seventh adjutant engaged to you, your whole system, all the way down to the foundation, you're using the first adjutant in a refined mode that allows the seventh adjutant to be on top of it. An amoeba is not using the first adjutant that, you know, in that refined mode. See, your whole nature is more delicate. And the only thing that changes that is the biologic uplift. That it really gives you sort of a basic biologic nature that is more seated on the integrity of the cosmos than this very difficult piling up you know, it's like a house of cards that you're building when you're trying to do this bottom up, right? And that house of cards analogy kind of works a little bit because the cards in the bottom level are just as, you know, delicate as the cards in the top level, right?
But it goes on to say, talk about, you know, were we uplifted by the Dharma?
See, so you're uplifted and you're literally, you're more hanging, you know, from the cosmos.
After our immune system or something, we would have been more immune to it.
Yeah, see, because the whole thing is predicated on an unassailable foundation then, you know, when you get that biologic uplift. Remember when they talk about health, sanity, and happiness, you know, that triplet?
Sure.
Yeah. See, how those all go hand in hand. I mean, see, that's the bottom-up indispensable fact of what's going on here. There can't be sanity, let alone happiness, if there isn't basic material, you know, biologic health. And therein lies the rub that I'm trying to describe. See, it's all this. I mean, there's a reason why the what you are right now doesn't take you very far. All right? I mean, you can't even take what you are right now to the first mansion world. I mean, it's just it's all just a very delicate thing built upon, you know, the most gracious of foundations, right? I mean, we're predicated on such a grace of just things being just so that you can actually build up something that can have a personality engage it upon such a fragile foundation. And we, that's why they warn us so many times about you got to take it seriously. It doesn't matter how much you think you can just will yourself to have a great relationship to God and treat your body like a garbage disposal. You're not a magical being like that, you know, that can just, perforce you serve two masters. It's all predicated on some very delicate chemistry and physics, right, all the way down to the foundation. Yep.
You're speaking to the truth of this, but the facts have long been understood, you know, people that are close to farm animals, you know, you feed pig slop.
Yeah.
And they eat it all up.
Yep.
Really quick. You know? Yep. The same food would make us.
They drink water you never drink.
Right.
You know,
right.
Chickens scratch around the barnyard through the manure piles to find the drain that had passed through.
Yeah.
Yes. That's food for them, but not food for us.
Yeah. See, so we haven't really stressed that. It's great that you kind of pushed this and to bring that out. That every time the evolutionary process was building up higher, you know, it was making the foundation more delicate. Right? Because it has to have a wholeness. See? You know, it's not just a fancy God potentially relating part on top. I mean, the whole thing has to be reformed all the way down to the foundation. You know, and so it just makes us, it makes it all the more important that we don't treat our basic biologic nature flippantly. And that we certainly don't start thinking self-righteously about it. It's like, well, I'm pretty sure that I've dreamt up this scheme, this chemistry scheme, you know, you can call it natural. You know, but it's still a chemistry scheme of what foods you're going to eat and whatnot, and boy, this is going to be better than anything that life carriers could design or anything like that. Okay, I mean, you got to be very careful. I mean, just to appreciate that there's this very fragile foundation of which we're basically clueless about. We know something about parts, but we know nothing about the wholeness of our nature. Right, that it encompasses even the most biologic foundations.
But what are we supposed to do with that? Because
just again,
what
you,
is the answer
a little, you know, be a little bit more trusting. Instead of trying to build a better body, you know, trust that things, you know, the naturalness of what we're doing, you know, is is appropriate. It'll get us there. I mean, notice the irony. People, on the one hand, get all fixated on wanting to eat naturally and not artificially, but their whole attempt to eat naturally is artificial. Right? I mean, they get into a mode where they're trying to micromanage, you know, it too much. I mean, yeah.
Using it, letting it be it sounded like you should be careful what you do.
Well,
and yeah, don't let it be like.
But again, it's a very fine line. It requires all kinds of wisdom, you know, because you can easily take all good things taken to extreme become bad. Eat any old thing, but don't get into that mode where you think you know exactly what to do, and you're going to micromanage what you ingest. I mean, so you're taking it too far. It's becoming a religion.
Right, I understand
that. That's the tricky part.
So, are you saying that we need to have a balance? You know, they might know some things, but there might be some things they're missing. But find a balance there, and keep open and keep trying.
That's part of what I'm saying. I mean, it's a very complex thing. Yeah, there's many things I could say here. I mean, for instance, don't forget that you will do more harm to your body worrying about what you eat than improving your body by making it what you put in the hole in your face slightly better. I mean, you have to find a balance here. You have to recognize it's a whole system. I mean, it may literally, objectively, be better to eat that than that. But in the process of worrying about not eating that, you actually completely negate the improvement of eating, you know, the better of the two things. I mean, remember, mind dominates matter. So it takes just a mustard seed of mind twisting to completely swamp any arithmetic improvement that you make, you know, in actually what you stick in the hole in your face. I mean, it's a very complex phenomenon that you can easily get yourself too much into it and be doing net, you know, not having a net positive when all is said and done with what you're up to, because you're so, you know, trying to build your way to paradise, you know, by putting, you know, new and improved stuff in the hole in your face.
You know, there's a thing called still mind control. Well, so the mind is so strong, so that, you know, God gave us the mind no matter what the life carriers did.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and again, I mean, how did Jesus often cure people? Not by using his magic wand. He just got them to do better mind over matter than what they were doing. I mean, their problem wasn't chemistry. He didn't need to pop a pill in the hole in their face, right? You know, or give them a better plant to eat or something. I mean, that wasn't the issue. The issue was mind over matter, right? And, you know, so, you know, that health, sanity, happiness, right? I mean, it works both ways. Poor health, you know, disrupts the mind, but poor mind disrupts the health. I mean, it works both ways. And then on top of it, like I was stressing, remember, mind dominates matter, right? So it's not, you know, it works both ways, but there's also, right, there's a fundamental top-down dominance to it. So what you want to take away is just to appreciate that it's very much like when you're trying to take delight in cultivating, improving your relationship to the Holy Spirit. There's an initial encirclement of the Holy Spirit you're given by grace, and it's well formed. What you want to do is humbly try to recognize the fact of that initial encirclement by grace and follow suit with it. There's an initial nature to you biologically that you want to try to follow suit with, rather than trying to dream up some scheme, right, to build a better you, right? It's, you want to try to know thyself and then follow that suit. I mean, because that foundation, you know, to be enter the kingdom of heaven, you have to become a little child, right? As Jesus, you know, like bringing that up. See, again, to go back to that foundational nature that you have by grace, be it matter, mind, or spirit, right? And try to play off of that. As we go forward, like we were talking about last time, we have a lot of genetic engineering and eugenics between now and the seventh stage of light and life, okay? All of that is going to be eventually done well because it's going to be done by imitating something that's worth imitating. Humans love to imitate. Remember, it started all the way back with the Andonites, you know, in a basic kind of a fancy animal sort of way, loving to imitate. Instead of imitating the ignorance of others, try to get aware of the cosmos, get aware of the harmony, and imitate that. Something worth imitating, right? Rather than, you know, like, oh, here's a really fancy scheme that someone dreamt up. I want to imitate that, you know, because they say that that will make me more spiritual or whatever. You know, just be, you know, have a tendency to seek first the kingdom of heaven rather than the kingdom of man, right, for what you should imitate. Right, go to the source, right? The real source, not the self-professed source of truth that's walking around in two legs somewhere.
Yeah. So, Chris, in a way, we can kind of ignore this problem because there's not much we can do biologically.
Right now. Yeah. So, back to this specific issue.
This is kind of a catastrophe, but we don't have what it takes to, on a biological level, to do anything about it.
Yeah. So,
except mind over.
So back to this issue, they'll speak to it in a moment here, but I mean, obviously, if fundamentally the biologic uplift was going to fix the disease-causing bacteria phenomenon, I mean, we just have to do likewise with genetic engineering.
But we don't have that right now.
And we don't have that right now.
So right now,
so that's
I don't
just
want to dwell on it.
Right, there's nothing to dwell on. It's just part of the scheme. As you see, they're gonna mention that here in a second. Okay.
The universe of universes, including this small world called Urantia, is not being managed merely to meet our approval, nor just to suit our convenience, much less to gratify our whims and satisfy our curiosity. The wise and all-powerful beings who are responsible for universe management undoubtedly know exactly what they are about, and so it becomes life carriers and behooves mortal minds to enlist in patient waiting and hearty cooperation with the rule of wisdom, the reign of power, and the march of progress.
I didn't want to give it away because it was coming up in the next paragraph. So, see, and again, the life carriers are encouraging us to do as they have to do. See, they're admitting their limitations to us. If they didn't trust, basically between the lines, they're saying the facts would make us hyperventilate. The facts would make us run around with our hair on fire, right? I mean, can they understand just how cataclysmic, right, it was that Adam and Eve defaulted relative to this issue, and how, from their perspective, we're screwed, right? They can't see how this comes out.
They don't have the bliss of ignorance.
I mean, you know, it appears this is a death sentence for the potential for the age of light and life. You can't get there. But they know that's not true, despite all appearances to the contrary, right? But see, they can speak to the appearances, but they know that the appearances are not the reality, right? You know, and for them, I mean, their appearances are 58 levels of deep into what we would call reality, right? I mean, our appearance, you know, appearance reality is a relative thing, right? And you know, you plumb the depth a little bit more and reality recedes, you know, and now what was reality is appearance. You plumb the depth a little bit more and reality recedes, and what was reality is now appearance. I mean, so, you know, they can plumb the depth very deeply, right? You know, and see an appearance at a very deep level that looks unfortunate. misfortunate, even, right? So, you know, they much more than, you know, in our ignorance, we'd ever have to do. If we knew what they knew, you know, we would just go catatonic in fear, right? But see, they steady themselves, and they can't plumb the wisdom of it, right? But they know there's a rule of wisdom. And a reign of power and a march of progress. And that there's somehow this goes forward. They know not how. But they know why it will. Right? They know the truth of it, even though they don't know the science of it.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of something they talk about later, the thing, you know, that we have to experience throughout the universe, which is the uncertainty with security. You know, the fact that... you're just uncertain about how it all falls out, but you know, you have that security that you're, you know, that the gods, whatever you want to call them, are know what they're doing, as they say yes. Here. They're behind it all, and it's, you know, it's all going to work out, even though it doesn't appear that way.
Yes, and
but that's kind of the beauty of it in a way.
It is, but here's,
for us,
you know, they're bringing up this example because this is where you're fundamentally tested in whether or not you can know the truth of what you just testified to. It's like, well, what about when the doctor says, okay, you've got an infection that's not curable, and it's going to be gruesome. It's going to eat you up from the inside out. It's going to be painful. Can you say to yourself, yes, but I know that I wouldn't be experiencing this disease-causing bacterial death if it wasn't the best thing that could be? See, that's what it was between, you know, notice that's what the life carriers are saying between the lines, right? They know, you know, see, undoubtedly know exactly what they are about. In other words, what's going on, all of this disease and death is somehow the best for us. Okay? And you go, no, that's impossible. It's like, well, but think about how you define good and bad and best and, right? Is it like what they started out? Is what's best merely to meet your approval or to suit your convenience? Is that how you decide? You know, wow, this meets my approval and this is very convenient, therefore it's good. Right? This is very inconvenient that I'm dying right now. Just as my little children, you know, need me desperately. And there's nothing anyone can do. I'm going to die and leave them. That's very inconvenient, quote unquote. Can you check yourself in labeling that as bad?
But even Jesus, when he was healing the sundown healing, you know, what they said was, you know, that he regretted that his sons, you know, the earlier times, had caused this condition to happen, so to speak. And even when, you know, the Tabamatia comes and he says, you know, I honor you for this strife-torn, grief-stricken, disease-afflicted world that you're on. So there is recognition that, you know, that we're at the bottom of the barrel, so to speak. And as you say... Yeah.
But the bottom of the barrel has the greatest potential.
The bottom of the barrel will probably be one of the reasons that in who knows when, in millions or billions of years from now, our whole existence is different because of the fact that we were at the bottom of the barrel and nobody else was.
Right, right. You know that's the case. Right. You know that's the case. Yeah, it's just, you know, can you hold on to that when the going, it's easy to testify to that when it's a theoretical thing, right? But when you're actually dying.
Likened to Don Green, maybe. Right. Many
can you hold on to it?
When he was, you know, right. In the end there.
Yeah.
And he kind of had a, you know, it was inspiring what he did.
That's the challenge. And to see, that's, you know, that's what's, you know, the fundamental thing between the lines. The life carriers are using themselves as an example for us to try to, is it, you know, to recognize that you will regret. Jesus even regretted. We regret. But you can't have that be the last word. Right? It wasn't the last word for Jesus. It's not the last word for the life carriers. We have to challenge ourselves for it to not to be the last word for us either. We've got to know, in spite of the fact of that inescapable regret, there's a part of me that is consecrated apart from that, and it's that part of me that gets resurrected. That's the real me. Don't eternalize regret. It's one, you know, temporal regret is unavoidable, even for someone like Jesus. Right? But don't falsely apply your personality to that and eternalize that. Right? Stand, you know, it is what it is. You can't magically make it disappear. Right? But remember, there's another part of you, and you're trying to slowly transfer the seat of your consciousness from the part of you that can't help but regret and the part of you that transcends regret. And right, so that's the basic lesson here.
I just wanted to say they're saying to trust the magnificent hierarchy.
Trust it.
Because we're so small compared to them. Yeah. And they are so wondrous and incredible. Yeah. I love trusting them.
Yeah. The
all of them.
There's, you know, no matter how successful we are in getting a hold of the whole, our highest potential wholeness right now is but a speck relative to the greater wholeness, right? The levels of wisdom go up ad infinitum, literally, right? and so there's always a greater wholeness in which there's greater wisdom, you know, and in which eventually you will transcend what seems to, you know, what appears to be not whole-like. All right. But again, just, and then the little bit of, you know, much less to gratify our whims or satisfy our curiosity, you know, again, you know, the experimental thing. It's not about whims and their, you know, arbitrary curiosity and stuff like that. All right. Yep.
You know, what you're saying, you know, definitely has a lot of spiritual power and truth to it, but I can't tell you how many times I hear from so many people, you know, well, if God really loved this world, this, it wouldn't be like this, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Going through all what we're talking about.
Yeah, right.
And I think it's difficult for a lot of people, you know, at this stage to be able to understand what you're saying in terms of, you know, going through these vicissitudes and coming out the other end, you know, greater than you would have come out without them, so to speak.
Yeah.
And then in a way, as you're saying, they're a blessing, though they don't appear to be.
Yeah, and you don't want to try to help people out of that with the fifth epical approach. You want the fourth epical approach. I mean, they don't, you know, think about how Jesus tried to help people with this, you know, and they go, why would God allow me, you know, to become diseased like this? Isn't God perfect? Doesn't God love me absolutely? What was Jesus' response to that? He didn't try to give them the big philosophic picture that we're trying to think about here. He just gave them a very simple fact. Remember, God is your spiritual father, not your material father, right? to find his, you know, the expression of his absolute love, don't look at your molecules. He's not your material father. His perfection is not manifest in your molecules, which it would be if he was your material father. He's your spiritual father. You will find his perfection with that other substance, that substance that's diametrically opposite from the matter, as far removed from the matter as you can get, at the other end of your mind. Not the end of your mind where the feelings are that's attached to the matter, the other end of your mind. Right? Your feelings keep you bound to matter. It's your thoughts, not your feelings, that lead you Godward. God is spirit. Right? And you've got, in order to let go of matter and find the God who is spirit, you have to let go of feelings. Because the feelings are inescapably tied to the matter. Right? You have to transcend those feelings to get to the God that Jesus was trying to reveal to us 2,000 years ago. Right? And the solution to this problem of why doesn't God care about my molecules is because he's not your material father. All right.
There are, of course, certain compensations for tribulation, such as Michael's bestowal on Urantia. But irrespective of all such considerations, the later celestial supervisors of this planet express complete confidence in the ultimate evolutionary triumph of the human race and in the eventual vindication of our original plans and life patterns.
That paragraph, the truth of that paragraph, is not as initially appears. Right? Notice it starts out probably right where you started out. You know, Michael promised to come again, and plus he came here in the first place, and that soothes me. That gets me to stop hyperventilating about these fearful things. No, they say, see, there's a bigger challenge here than kind of just falling back on the fourth epical revelation. The fifth epical revelation is trying to get you to have a much more holistic response to that than just kind of hoping for, that basically that magic guy to come again. Anamanalantan to return or whatever, it is, the golden age to be brought back. But irrespective of all such considerations, can you set that sort of religious answer, if you will, aside and find something bigger, a philosophic answer, right? And something that requires not merely faith, but trust. They express complete confidence in the ultimate evolutionary triumph. Right? I mean, to trust the evolutionary process. And that even though it appears right now, even to the life carriers, that their design had some holes in it. When all is said and done, it's like, no, it really doesn't. Even though it appears to. The later celestial supervisors remind the life carriers of that and for us to try to find that deeper thing instead of just kind of falling back on that sort of easy salve, if you will, to soothe you.
Can you, when you're doing that, trying to see the bigger picture, to think about for the Supreme and the big picture, these aren't really holes. These are actually filling in the holes.
Instead of praying for the father parent to come in and fill an apparent hole, trust the other parent, the individuality of the whole, to know that there really aren't any holes that you need to pray for the Father to come in and fill. There really aren't any HOLEs in the WHOLE.
Yeah, I was thinking about when I said these are actually health spending, the spectrum of evolutionary or experiential evolution, that's the supreme.
And another way to just think about that contrast is the way I always paraphrase that line up in the Marriage and Family papers, right? About that which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution will always achieve. Right? See, revelation failed to accomplish. Say, how does this section start out? The Caligasty betrayal and the Adamic default, right? The first and second epical revelations failed to accomplish many things, right? And see, and those are downstepped expressions of father-like intervention. Praying for that intervention to fix something, you know, kind of fiat-like, father-like. And panicking when that doesn't happen, and you shouldn't. There's another parent, right? See, and that other parent is all over it already, right? You want to pray to recognize the fact of the other parent. And that despite all appearances to the contrary, you don't really need an intervention. You don't really need it, right? We will get father-like, you know, descending sons. Yes, we will. We will get them. But just notice that there's always that backdrop. That which revelation fails to accomplish, evolution will always achieve, right? I'll take myself as an individual example. I can have all kinds of exalted thoughts that I'm indispensable to the cosmos, but I'm not. You know, if I fail to be a father-like part, you know, revealing into the universe, I won't prevent the grand universe from being settled in line life.
And maybe we're a poster child for that comment.
Right? I mean, my iniquity is not, you know, a showstopper. Right? See, I mean, rebellions are not showstoppers. Defaults are not. I mean, not those sons, you know, those father-like interventionary hands can be made up for over a long span of time, yes, through a lot of complexity, by the other parent who is already there, already fills all of the apparent holes, HOLEs. They aren't, right? They aren't really HOLEs, right? And it's just that you have to wait a long time for the apparent HOLE to be filled in by the other parent, right? But it will be filled in just as definitively as if a Lenonadec did what they were supposed to have done, right? And so, taking that step from just approaching your problems religiously to approaching them philosophically, to going from the fourth epical revelation to the fifth, is bringing in the other parent. Remember, that's the fundamental addition. Bringing in the other parent and then getting reciprocally an improved understanding of the parent that you've known about for a long time. Right? But fundamentally, it's bringing in that other parent and bringing in the potential for trust. Bringing in a peace that passes all understanding. Right? Bringing in a peace into time that the Father can't offer you. The Father can't offer you a peace in time. The Father has no relationship to time. Right? You need to bring in the parent that has a relationship to time to have a peace in time.
Right? I understand the point you're making, but is this not a father-like intervention, this revelation?
Yes, right? See, they're... But if this fails to accomplish what they hope, it's not the end. And we'll still get the light and life. It's all just, the father-like intervention catalyzes, but the fundamental nature of what that intervention is trying to bring is already inherent in the whole, and it'll slowly percolate in, and you'll get exactly, when all is said and done, what you would have gotten just by this fiat plopping it down in front of you, right? There's great mystery. I admit there's great mystery there. It's like, well, why is there descending suns at all then? Why isn't it all just done? I mean, I can't answer those questions, but just appreciate that they're trying to give us this recognition that don't just turn the fifth epical revelation into a bigger pile of divine intervention possibilities. Wow, now not just God the Father could intervene, but boy, they've told me about a million different ones, and I could pray for that one to intervene, and that one to intervene. That's not what you're supposed to be doing with it. The big thing that you're supposed to be doing is getting the whole. Jesus had peace that passes all understanding because his relationship to the Mother, not to the Father. There's several examples like that, those contrasting. You can have this incredible relationship to the Father, first circler, but you still languish and stumble along in moral darkness. And no amount of improved relationship to the Father is going to fix that problem. Right? People with all kinds of relationship to the Father still are corks in the ocean. So, the degree to which someone does have an enduring peace, you might say, right, is the degree to which they have an unrecognized relationship to the other parent, to the mother, to the whole. All right. So there's a whole bunch there, obviously. Four simple little paragraphs, it seems, but took us a whole hour to do it. Okay, so let's continue on. Now they're gonna get down into the details a little bit more. You can tell by the title, the word technique, right in there. So some of these things have all kinds of scientific consequences. This is not the place to try to explore those. Like I've said a number of times, we'll just kind of note some of those scientific elements in passing. But let's see what else they give us here.
It is impossible.
Well, read the title first.
Oh, sorry. 6, Evolutionary Techniques of Life. It is impossible accurately to determine simultaneously the exact location and the velocity of a moving object. Any attempt at measurement of either inevitably involves change in the other. The same sort of paradox confronts mortal man when he undertakes the chemical analysis of protoplasm. The chemist can elucidate the chemistry of dead protoplasm, but he cannot discern either the physical organization or the dynamic performance of living protoplasm. Ever will the scientist come nearer and nearer the secrets of life, but never will he find them, and for no other reason than that he must kill protoplasm in order to analyze it. Dead protoplasm weighs the same as living protoplasm, but it is not the same.
That last one, of course, everyone probably knows that humans have long, had notions that, you could weigh the difference between someone when they're alive and dead. And it's like, oh, something is definitely left. Think of how materialistic a thought that is, see? that's just how hopelessly material-oriented we think about things. That everything, is a mass. Okay. Okay, and the basic difference between dead and living protoplasm doesn't have anything to do with mind energy or spirit energy either. Right, what's the basic difference? That very intangible fact called life animation, which is so not weighable, right, that you shouldn't even think of it as an object or an energy, you know, or any similar sort of notion. You know, it's like personality. It's an influence of deep, infinite mystery, okay?
But you have to kill it to measure it.
Right. So, yeah, so to get to the science there, see, so again, this speaks to what I was saying earlier about the delicate nature of the system as a whole, as a living wholeness, as an organism, rather than just a collection of molecules that you can analyze. See, it's so delicate, see, they're pointing out that, you know, you can't touch it gently enough without fundamentally altering it so that you aren't measuring its true nature. Right? That whole bit, you know, in the beginning there, they're giving that, you know, it is impossible accurately to determine simultaneously the exact location and the velocity of a moving object. And I mean, in order to measure something, you've got to interact with it to some degree, no matter how slight. And so, yeah, I mean, in practical terms, right, if you don't need to know an infinite number of decimal places, like, you can get the location and the velocity. But see, just notice how they say it, accurately, exact, right, it's a full precision. No, I mean, if you're going to, if you pin down one, you've modified the other, okay? And for those of you in the know that quantum mechanics rationalization schemes play off of that. That's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle and stuff like that. But see, they immediately shift from that sort of mechanics example to the living thing and appreciate that there's not only is there a subtleness to a lot of the material for physical aspects of you as a system, there's something even subtler that's very foundational, this life animation fact that is giving a wholeness to it that is just completely intangible. And see, never can be gotten to, as they're saying there at the end. Come nearer and nearer to the secrets of life, but never, right? You actually get there. So I said, well, how is it that scientists on any world really come to understand the real nature, the true nature of living things then? It's revealed, right? You can't get at this reality through observation. It has to be revealed to you. Like we've stressed again so many times, this difference between appearance and reality. Right, so the fifth epical revelation is the first time that celestial beings are giving us some greater details about the nature of living things. The things that have to be revealed, that you can't discover through experiment, observation, whatnot, you know, or just extrapolative speculation, okay? Bottom-up sort of extrapolation. It just has to be revealed to you. You know, and there's very subtle things involved when they contrast dead and living. Remember, there's 10 forms of physical energy. 7 of them are dead energies and 3 are living energies. Right, so there's even that subtlety, you know, which is separate from life animation. There's all this complexity that's completely not under, there's nothing in current science that hints at those 7 forms of dead energy or anything like that. That's completely beyond anything we have any hint of right now. Okay, so... Yeah, but the main thing that is just what we were saying earlier, just to appreciate how subtle a system you are. Okay, what else did I say here? Yep.
David Jones, his impression of that first sentence is that he thinks it applies to subatomic particles, and there might be an overstatement in
general. Like I said, I mean, if anyone knows anything about quantum mechanics, you go, oh, this is like talking about the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's like, no, it isn't. It's talking about just more basic, not the extrapolation into quantum mechanics. It's just a simple fact that, you think about if you're going to, try to get what the velocity of something is. I mean, you got to touch it, quote unquote, in some way, right? You can't just mystically deduce what velocity it is, in some non-touching way. You've got to interact with it some way, right? You're going to alter its state. There's no way to just sort of mystically divine, what the state of the system is.
Chris, I just have a little tangent. Mm-hmm. So if life animation comes from the infinite, what is the first step down from that? The downstepping, what was the first downstepping from the infinite be?
It comes down through the life animation comes from the reservoir of the infinite down through two facets of deity, if you will, through the mother and through the spirit. Okay.
So which mother first, then?
The mother, no individual, not thinking about any individual, but just mother deity, its full hierarchy. Goes all the way up to the infinite level and can come all the way down to here. So the basic foundational nature of the first phase of life animation, living vitality, is brought down purely by Mother Deity. You juice it up, you get this modification to the second phase of life animation, the reproductive spark, by having the spirit in combination with the mother. And again, the spirit goes all the way from the top all the way down. We have a downstepped expression of both, as an individual that embodies both mother deity and spirit type deity, right? Our creative mother spirit.
Mm-hmm. But that most upper level wouldn't be the eternal mother son. It's who?
It starts with the infinite mother spirit.
The infinite mother spirit. Yeah. Okay.
That's the mother at the top there. Enough. Right. Yeah.
Certainly couldn't know that without revelation.
No. But see, it just notice, it starts with the third source and center, not the first source and center. It's the other end of the spectrum.
That is cool to think about.
All right. Let's keep going here.
There is original endowment of adaptation in living things and beings. In every living plant or animal cell, in every living organism, material or spiritual, there is an insatiable craving for the attainment of ever-increasing perfection of environmental adjustment, organismal adaptation, and augmented life realization. These interminable efforts of all living things evidence the existence within them of an innate striving for perfection.
All right, so they're getting you to think very holistically. Don't just think about your potential as a person. Because of the gift of personality, to have this very individuated relationship to perfectingness. I mean, it's not just about those kinds of parts. Everything, is encompassed in the wholeness and is perfecting. So there, it doesn't matter how lowly the plant or animal or whatever you're talking about. It's all part of this, you know, original endowment of adaptation. And you can even go beyond the life, like we often do. I mean, all of the non-living matter is part of that whole evolutionary wholeness that's perfecting as well. It's all one triune system. But the immediate thing here is that they want to focus on, remember, this is over control of evolution paper, it's about that whole mind, you know, over matter, that mind engaging matter, and giving you the basic answer to why the matter evolves. You know, there's this influence imposed upon it from above, and you have that immediate adaptability potential that's in mind, right? So that you, when mind engages living matter, that becomes adapting life, right? That potential of adaptability actualizes in the living matter as adapting life. And to see that in a very holistic way. Let's see, anything else there?
And spiritual,
not just right. Spiritual. See, I see, and yeah, notice, like I said, you know, they're giving very big picture. You know, even bringing in, you know, if you're talking about a living organism, its body is made out of, you know, has a lot of spirit energy in it, like a seraphim or a, you know, divine counselor or whatever, right? Yeah, so. In the biggest sense, you've got this, it's just innate. It's inescapable that the only way to escape this insatiable craving for the attainment of ever-increasing perfection in all ways is to cease to exist. It is to just literally no longer be. Right? If you are, you're part of this. We're fundamentally an evolutionary phenomenon. Okay. They're stressing, they're italicizing the living there, just, you know, in contrast to the previous, or to build upon the previous paragraph of, you know, that's that first very mysterious, fascinating element that's added to the matter that ultimately makes this all possible. This engagement of mind and then the engagement of spirit, the engagement of personality. It's all predicated on the potential of variability that comes into play when that life animation engages these properly designed energy systems, be they material or spiritual. So that's sort of the, you want to think about it in simplistic terms, it's the lubricant, you know, that you add to matter, to dead matter, so that it's changeable, right? So that it can flow, if you will. Yeah. All right.
The most important step in plant evolution was the development of chlorophyll-making ability, and the second greatest advance was the evolution of the spore into the complex seed. The spore is most efficient as a reproductive agent, but it lacks the potentials of variety and versatility inherent in the seed.
Okay, so just, you know, a little, start with the first part. You see there the chlorophyll making ability. See, and notice, see, that was an important step in plant evolution. You know, so from the time they implanted the single celled plants, somewhere down the road, right, you evolved chlorophyll making ability. So you didn't have that initially. Right? I mean, it's, you know, they built the initial plants, right? They didn't evolve, you know, those initial single-celled plants they put in the seed. They built them. The life carriers built them, right? They built all the molecules that are in them, including the chlorophyll molecules, and they set them loose. And then, see, and so this brings in a whole fascinating thing, see, of how, you know, how far down the road, you could ask, did did that evolve where the plants could kind of say, you know, it'd be handy if we could make chlorophyll that evolved into existence. So it's because that chlorophyll making ability wasn't there to begin with. That's why they can speak like they did, like I said, about pre-chlorophyll. They don't mean literally pre-chlorophyll. They mean pre-chlorophyll making. See, free in that sense.
Interesting.
See?
How could these pre-chlorophyll energize?
Well, again, they had chlorophyll. They just couldn't make it themselves. I mean, think about those initial cyanobacteria that the primary associators built, those master physical controllers built. I mean, they built the chlorophyll molecules in them, and those are eternal little machines. You know, unless something squishes it, it just goes on and on and on. I mean, do you have to worry about a water molecule aging and falling apart? No, we think that, but organic stuff decays. It's like, no, that's because it's being consumed, right? I mean, if you don't let it get eaten, by bacteria, the tree that falls in the forest stays there forever. I mean, molecules are eternal.
I was always under the impression that this chlorophyll, I agree with that. But yeah. I always thought they were incorporated into.
Well, some modification, obviously, of those little power plants were put in as the chloroplasts in the initial plants, the initial eukaryotic plants. Yes, but see again, it's just you don't consume the chlorophyll molecule. It's just there to absorb photons. You know, look up the whole bit about how that works. You know, right. You know, so if it isn't destroyed for some reason, it's just there chugging away. It's the machine that it is. It's this molecular machine, right? But eventually things get complicated, and the organisms have to be able to. To make up for vicissitudes, like we were just reading, right? That transitions into the other part of that paragraph. So you start out with spores. You can see, without getting into the science of it, you can see the basics there. You start out with spores. Why, you might say? It's like, well, they tell you. Right? What does it say there? The spore is most efficient. Not even more, but most, see. So it starts out, things need to be simple, very efficient. Right? So coincidentally, that's how it evolves. Yeah, but then eventually, you need to have greater complexity potentials, right, in play. And so then it goes to the seeds. It's less efficient, but it's, right? Yeah, it has the potentials of variety and versatility that you're looking for. Okay, so they're giving you, without going into any scientific consequence of what they're saying, just, notice how they're reminding you of this delightful plan, right, that's all built in from the beginning. You know, all these quote-unquote coincidentallys, I am always doing air quotes, about, right, how that's all built in. And it all unfolds when they need to be able to make chlorophyll. Ta-da! They can make chlorophyll, and right, because now it's going to be in a more complex situation, and chlorophyll is going to be lost, and so you got to be able to regenerate it from simpler molecules, and all that machinery comes into play. But initially, it's all just very self-contained and eternal-like, right? But the more temporal-like the organism becomes. Right? See, the more complex it's got to get to make up for all the vicissitudes of time. There are no vicissitudes in eternity. So Yeah, that's what they're getting. That's the main point of that little paragraph, is just how the life carriers took that into account. And again, notice another between the lines. It's getting more and more complex. There's more and more ways it can break. Right? You know, and by the time it gets to us, right, it has a million and one, you know, ways that, you know, it can be damaged. And it all becomes very, very delicate. Okay.
One of the most serviceable and complex episodes in the evolution of the higher types of animals consisted in the development of the ability of the iron in the circulating blood cells to perform in the double role of oxygen carrier and carbon dioxide remover. And this performance of the red blood cells illustrates how evolving organisms are able to adapt their functions to varying or changing environment. The higher animals, including man, oxygenate their tissues by the action of the iron of the red blood cells, which carries oxygen to the living cells and just as efficiently removes the carbon dioxide. But other metals can be made to serve the same purpose. The cuttlefish employs copper for this function, and the sea squirt utilizes vanadium.
Okay, so besides the kind of the scientific fascination of, you know, using other metals than iron, like copper and vanadium, you know, so like if you're a cuttlefish, you know, your blood is kind of a fascinating green blue, right, instead of red. Okay. So besides those kind of basic factual scientific curiosities there, do you immediately recognize kind of the fundamental difference between these higher animals, including man, right, that have the iron doing this, and those other two? What's the basic difference in biology? They talk about we are a kind of an animal, and those cuttlefish and sea squirts are another kind of animal. There's one word that they use to distinguish. Something that goes down the middle of your back. Right. So notice that those two are invertebrates. Right. So in the more primitive invertebrates, right, you were using various, you know, different metals, right? But it's all eventually zeroing in on, it's got to get to using iron when it gets to heading towards the will creatures. Right? So there's all that adaptability, that complexity.
Not to mention Hagendon or steel doesn't work well with
yeah. And how can you have Hagendon or steel if it's vanadium? Yeah. But especially copper, that's just way too bendy. okay, so there's that. You know, just, you know, thinking about that whole adaptability. Remember, you know, they're talking about adaptability here and adapting life. That whole complex process, like we talked about, it's searching around, you know, in all kinds of different modes, and then it finds a way up. And then the other little thing, you know, that you may not have thought about your red blood cells, right? That's a sophistication down the road where, you know, you have both an oxygen carrier and a carbon dioxide remover. You've got one fact doing double duty. It's like, well, that's really efficient and kind of cool. Yeah, but, you know, think about how it might be a little more robust if you had, you know, something tailored to each rather than something that has to do double duty. See, again, like I said, it's getting more and more complex, right? And one thing having a problem has even greater consequences than before. Right? So that growing, inescapable fragility that comes in with complexity. You know, and yet, of course, I'm saying we're fragile, but, you know, we're also amazingly robust. You can throw a lot of things in the hole in your face and you don't die. You know, you can whack your body around in amazingly brutal ways and you don't die. So the life carriers gave us a robustness, you know, that we need because of the vicissitudes of living. But don't just think about it materially like that. Right? When I'm talking about this fragility, what I'm talking about is you being a human, not being a fancy animal. The fancy animal, in relative terms, is quite robust. Your human nature is quite fragile. Right? Everything has to be just so for there to be any possibility of you actually using your mind in a human fashion rather than just a fancy animal fashion. Okay? See, so again, this whole, I mean, Jesus tried to get this started, you know, and saying, you know, God is spirit. Right? Try to get us, you know, and how unsuccessful he was at trying to get people away from rationalizing and fixating on matter about everything. Right? It's, you know, just appreciate that you could, you know, you might find ways of positively impacting the animal part of you that's quite observable and you're quite familiar with. But it's sad to record that so few persons on your ranch really have much familiarity at all with their human nature. It's very high and difficult to get to, and it's impossible to get to if you're doing things that don't appear to really mess up your animal fanciness at all. You do all the same fancy animal things you've always done, but you've just short-circuited any potential for you to be doing that human stuff that, it's sad to record, we're basically clueless about.
What has to be just so? What do you
mean? I mean, again, if I could tell you what has to be just so, I'd be a life carrier. Right? All sorts of subtle, non-part-like things about our biology and our mind and everything, that all has to be just so in order for those human potentials to be able to actualize.
So you're saying that it's impossible because it's not just so, and we have to overcome it even though it's not just so.
Well, you know it's not impossible because you have a personality. The creative mother spirit found a way to take your lumpen nature, you know, and get it encircled in the Holy Spirit. It's possible. Now, theoretically, some really advanced human nature is impossible. Okay, you know, you're not going to function like a human on a world in the third stage of light and life, no matter how perfect your diet is or anything, right? How much you consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother or anything. I mean, you can't get there. But remember what the revelers say. I mean, there's a lot that you could be of a human quality that it's sad to record that so few persons take delight in cultivating. Right? We could actualize some of those human potentials. Remember how we just read about that? All these human potentials that got built up through the evolutionary process? We're still pretty much a blob of human potentials, not human actuals. Fancy animal actuals, merely potential. Right? And that's what we're talking about, is that the delicateness of being able to actualize those potentials.
So we have to kind of override that not just so-ness, because we don't have it, period, biologically. So it has to be mind over matter, personality in play.
Again,
that's the only way.
I mean, the spirit ministries will take care of a lot of the details. We just have to allow them to begin to function. Okay. All right. Okay. Is there anything else there? No, I think we can keep going here.
The continuation of such biologic adjustments is illustrated by the evolution of teeth in the higher Urantia mammals. These attained to 36 in man's remote ancestors, and then began an adaptive readjustment toward 32 in the dawn mammal and his near relatives. Now the human species is slowly gravitating toward 28. The process of evolution is still actively and adaptively in progress on this planet.
Okay, so there's still evolution. Like, well, wait a minute, I thought they said that, you know, about 40,000 years ago we reached the apex of evolution and that's why the biologic uplifters came. Yeah, the vertical. There's still horizontal evolution. See, adaptively, right? There's still horizontal evolution. So going from 36 to 32 to 28 teeth, right, is a horizontal evolution phenomenon.
Okay, right? I was wondering
about
losing my teeth.
Now, I mean, you know, so everyone can kind of think, you know, it's like, well, you know, you notice how it's, you know, they're slowly gravitating toward 28. I mean, I'm an example. I never got my wisdom teeth, right? So, you know, I'm in the 28 mode. Matter of fact, I mean, I'm technically in the 26 mode. I didn't get adult teeth of two more of my molars, so I'm even pushing to the next step after 28.
That was one of the things I was going to bring up when I get to life carrier school, giving us more teeth.
And of course, we know there's occasionally an individual that has a whole mess of teeth in their mouth. See, and they're just reminding you. See, that's a recessive thing. They're going back to when, you know, there was a lot more teeth to begin with. You know, having, you know, nine on each, each quarter, right? For instance. Yeah. So
Chris, yep. We're on our own. You know, which I don't know if it's in this paper or whatever. And as we learn genetics better, more and more over time,
mm-hmm.
Our ability to get back to where we're supposed to be will probably occur. Even though, as you're saying, Adam and Eve weren't here, evolution will still gradually put us to, you know, to lighten life or to develop physical systems.
Yeah, see, but of course, you know, part of that evolution is that, you know, involving, you know, the intellect and the wisdom stuff to do genetic engineering, all that. You know, I mean, that genetic engineering is part of the evolutionary process.
So the evolution won't just be lateral, it'll then begin to move upwards a little bit, correct?
Yeah, see, right. I mean, but see, the reason it's going up is because of our individual personality management,
right?
You know, right. Moving it upward, yeah. Yeah, but just remember, you're an evolutionary phenomenon. See, so that whole development of the science to do that—that's an evolutionary phenomenon, right? Where we would develop that science through this evolutionary process. You know, rather than being given the science, you know, by Adam and Eve, like on a normal world. See, it's only minimally evolutionary on a normal world. Science, you know, a lot of it is being disclosed. Yeah, I mean, some of it, but they're the main scientists, you know, the material son and daughter. Okay, and then the thing I want to point out, stressing this horizontal, you know, especially bringing myself in and saying, you know, ooh, I've got 28, okay? No, horizontal, Chris, not vertical. Right, you're different, but not better, right? Okay, you go, well, why is it evolving horizontally? Well, see, that's an interesting question, see? I mean, you know, why is it going from 36 to 32 to 28? I mean, you know, even to 24 maybe apparently. I mean, you know, what exactly is that? Is that horizontal thing something about like we saw in the past when it was all just kind of doing it on its own? It was searching around horizontally, finding a way up? It's like, well, it's not going to go up naturally anymore, like we were just saying. Yeah, but maybe in order for us to even genetically engineer it upward, it has to shift horizontally some, naturally. So you could just see how complex this must all be, and what kind of wisdom we're going to have to. You know, we can't just jump in with some incredible notion and just take a straight up. There's probably all kinds of horizontal movement that has to be done, too. I mean, we have to, you know, personally manage ourselves what the creative Mother Spirit, most immediately, was managing, that combination of horizontal and vertical through all those hundreds of millions of years. We're going to have to do that. It's like, well, we need to go up, but you can't. If we go up just straight up, that'll be bad. We need to go over and then over here and then over here, and then we need to go up. But I'm really impatient to go way, way up. And it's like, no, you can't. So I'm sure there'll be some very unfortunate things that'll be done, you know, in impatience, where we try to take it straight up rather than, you know, horizontally some and then up, and, you know, and we'll get some very unfortunate result. Anyway, we have to see again. It's like you want to try to imitate what's done by grace, if you will. Even there, same thing. Same as you taking delight in cultivating, doing the same as what was done for you by grace with that encirclement of the Holy Spirit. Not something radically, you know, your own, right? That's rebellion, right? That's thinking it's all about you. Okay, so it's just a kind of a universal phenomenon that it's coming out here.
So taking the same potential example as your teeth, you know, you also notice that more and more people's eyesight's getting terrible on a worldwide level, so to speak. It seems to be evolving to where more and more people have to wear something. So I'm just wondering, when you think about that, is that also a lateral... maybe not evolution.
Well, remember, there's two things. You know, this is an example of, this is obviously a positive thing that's supposed to happen, and it is happening. There's a whole bunch of other things that have to do with our decaying genetic nature. You know, and that's part of the emergency situation, and why the Revelators, boy, they sure do hope that when, you know, that Machaventa assumes planetary prince sum and he takes the role of material son, because, boy, the genetic situation is getting dicey. And there, someone's going to have to intervene here pretty soon, you know, because they're falling apart. You know, we're getting more and more and more genetic diseases with each generation. It's, you know, it's getting very problematic, yeah. See, and again, that's because we didn't get that biologic uplift where you're more fundamentally anchored on the constancy of the cosmos. We're, you know, built on that rock. We're built on sand still. And it didn't appear we were built on sand, but in the recent decades, it's starting to become apparent that we're built upon sand, and more things are just falling apart.
And as the oceans rise,
we're getting more and more sensitive to the environment, to things that we shouldn't be sensitive to. I mean, think about how ridiculous it is to have hay fever. You're allergic to the environment that we evolved in for hundreds of millions of years. I mean, that's absurd.
That's what one of my ex-wives
used to
say about hay fever.
Right, there's just, we're getting very we're getting brittle, you know, even as a fancy animal, let alone how it's fundamentally fragile, isn't it, in the potential for human nature. Okay.
But many seemingly mysterious adjustments of living organisms are purely chemical, wholly physical, and at any moment of time in the bloodstream of any human being, there exists the possibility of upward of 15 million chemical reactions between the hormone output of a dozen ductless glands.
Right, that whole, you know, like the endocrine system, all the glands that dump right into the, you know, into the blood vessels, you know, and don't have separate ducts, you know, ductless glands. Okay, so why did they throw that in? They're reminding you of, there's a lot of things seemingly mysterious adjustments. You're going, oh, well, that has to do with that mind thing, engaging the body. No, don't forget there's a huge complexity just mechanically, materially mechanically. Okay? Mind definitely does a lot of things. But there is, you know, as they're trying to stress here, you know, 15 million chemical reactions. It's a hormone output of these glands. Remember, hormones are fundamentally, going from point A to point B, and affecting some remote part of the body relative to where the hormone was constructed. So it's this very non-local complex thing. See, so you could start to think, oh, well, it's so holistic. You know, it must be that wholeness of mind engaging the body. No, it's just the translational, and just fundamental complexity of all of the chemistry that's going on in the body.
Designed.
And it's designed that way. Again, very, very complex, man. Like I've been stressing, it's built up to an extremely complex system. A zillion and one ways that something could be out of whack, right? And remember, this is extremely important to the thing that you hold near and dear to your heart, that desire to have a relationship with that God who is spirit, rather than just believing in some notion of God as a material thing, like material phenomenon in a burning bush or something. Right? Remember what they told us about the hormonal production. I mean, your whole ability for your mind to have any relationship to spirit energy is predicated on the secretions of some of those glands. Right? See, so all it would take is for your gland chemistry to be slightly off. You can forget about being more spiritual. In reality, your mind can't synchronize with spirit energy. Your mind energy can't synchronize with spirit energy. It's like, well, why? It's about mind energy, spirit energy. No, but the mind energy is attuned to the physical energy.
While you're human.
Yeah, while you're human.
While you're immortal.
Yeah, right? Yeah, so
it goes away after.
That's something that's between the lines there, besides just reminding you of how complex the material system is and can function in seemingly holistic ways that don't have nothing to do with the transcendent wholeness of mind engagement. They told you those hormones have big consequences. So again, I brought that up because that human, you want to, this whole, it's sad to record that so few human potentials are being actualized. We all have lots and lots of human potentials. They've been there for 40,000 years. Right? But very few of them are being actualized. And it starts with simple facts like this. There's some issue with a gland. Okay, so it just stresses what we've been, going. I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but just there it is again. That's the basic picture they're trying to remind you of, how complex this is. Okay.
That kind of blows me away. Mm-hmm. 15 million chemical reactions.
Yeah.
And you think of all the different things in your body that are working together.
Yeah, look how much you're taking for granted.
Yes, and right. Then to know how this works with matter, mind, and spirit, and then personality, and how it really needs to harmonize.
Yeah.
And
See that your functioning as a human is predicated on your triunity. See, and that's just is between the lines, really stressed there. On the one hand, it's just gland chemistry, isn't it? What's the big deal? It's like, no, but to be related to spirit, you can't just be related to spirit. You have to be related to spirit in a triunity. And if the material element is not there, the triunity can't be there.
You can't synchronize.
Right, there isn't that harmony potential. See, you need more than spiritual potential. You need harmony potential. That's your human potential.
No one knows
Oh, right? See,
that's even a beginning of an idea.
Yeah, see, and that's why it's so important to not overstress the whole spiritual thing like everyone does. Yeah, obviously you need a relationship to spirit. But what you're seeking is not merely your actualizing your spiritual potential, finding some technique for apparently actualizing your spiritual potentials. You want to somehow, that's a means to a greater end. You want to figure out how to actualize your cosmic potentials, your harmony potentials, your human potentials.
Don't you think that people, there's so many people on the planet right now that for different reasons, they're pushing so hard to hold on to evolutionary religion.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to go off on another tangent here, but just, I mean, just, you know, just note again, what I, do we, you know, is there any human that understands all of this incredible complexity? Huh. No. That's why I was saying what I said at the very beginning. We all need to back off of this false certitude we had where we think, oh, I know all the details. I can micromanage myself into a transcendent human being. No, you can't. I mean, you got to just trust that you'll be grown into something more worthy, and try to very humbly do things. Be cautious about trying to get too sophisticated, quote unquote, about what you're going to do to improve yourself, because it's just so incredibly complicated. Most likely, you know, you'll mess up as many things as you fix. So you want to try to just kind of let it be as it is, as the little child, where it's all together there by grace, and try to just slowly work in parallel with that and see if you're grown forward. You know, remember how in 103, paper 103, it tells you both scientists and religionists, you know, need to be much more humble about what they think they know. Okay, let's keep on here.
The lower forms of plant life are wholly responsive to physical, chemical, and electrical environment. But as the scale of life ascends, one by one, the mind ministries of the seven adjutant spirits become operative, and the mind becomes increasingly adjustive, creative, coordinative, and dominative. The ability of animals to adapt themselves to air, water, and land is not a supernatural endowment, but it is a superphysical adjustment.
Okay, so that's pretty obvious at the end, I think, to everyone. You know, we have this tendency to think of everything as supernatural. It's like, no, it's not supernatural, but it is supermaterial or superphysical, yes. Mind is not matter. You know, and we usually understand it, you know, to begin with in that vertical, you know, analogy. So it's above the physical, right? It's super physical. Carefully notice the suffixes on those fancy words in there. Adjust-ive, create-ive, coordinative, right? Dominative, right? The I-V-E suffix, tending to, right? Right? So they're speaking to the truth of it, right? Once you get above just the mechanical mind of plants, you know, and you have just that basic stimulus response phenomenon there, and you start moving up in the adjutants, you see the so-called spirits of promise here, right? You know, there's promising things. You don't literally have the coordination of the mother in play yet when all you have is the first adjutant, but you see it's moving in that direction. And it's getting even closer when you bring in the second adjutant, and closer still when you bring in the third. And it's moving towards those high human things, like adjusters, rather than just adjustive. right, et cetera. Of course, we often stress you'll never be a creator. You'll always be merely creative. Right? See, you're always just tending to God, not actually getting there. Right? God-like. you will embody coordination and et cetera. They give me that whole vertical context, and they emphasize the plant thing. That harkens you back to what we were saying in the previous section about, oh yeah, how problematic it is when you have the vegetable assault, pounding on the foundation, right? The whole IVE is predicated on that, right? You're tending to that predicated on vegetable. All right, keep going.
His name wasn't Sandon.
Yes, we were built upon sand, yes, okay.
Physics and chemistry alone cannot explain how a human being evolved out of the primeval protoplasm of the early seeds. The ability to learn, memory, and differential response to environment is the endowment of mind. The laws of physics are not responsive to training. They are immutable and unchanging. The reactions of chemistry are not modified by education. They are uniform and dependable. Aside from the presence of the unqualified absolute, electrical and chemical reactions are predictable, but mind can profit from experience, can learn from reactive habits of behavior in response to repetition of stimuli.
Rather than just the same response to the same stimulus over and over and over again. The plant doesn't learn, doesn't have teachable mind, just has mechanical mind. So most of that is pretty straightforward, but unfortunately, not for some of the most brilliant people on the planet. Right? I mean, you see what's being talked about there. You know, they're going, seriously, people, you think you're nothing but matter? Have you studied matter? Has it ever learned anything? When did an oxygen molecule learn something? When? Which experiment shows it learning something? Or even a fancy hydrocarbon, right? If you talk to a barrel of oil, does it learn?
I got better mileage.
Right. I mean, it's so trivially obvious that we aren't just matter. Where does teachability come from?
I feel that way talking to my kids.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times they act like plants, right? All they've got is just, this unteachable, utterly predictable response to a stimulus. Yeah, that never changes.
Unqualified absolute, we're not
going to
skip over.
Yeah, just quickly there, aside from the presence of the unqualified absolute, I mean, there's two ways to think about that little zinger they throw in there.
Yeah, like, why did they throw it in?
Okay, from a seven absolutes of infinity, sort of an individuality viewpoint, the way you can understand why that might throw in something that's not predictable is remember that if you take the unqualified absolute, the universal absolute, and the deity absolute, and you put them together in eternity, you have the absolute personalized as God the absolute, who does not sort of engage us top down, but wraps around and bubbles up from the other side, you know, from the bottom up, apparently not as a person at all, but as three reservoirs of potential. And right. So that's one way to understand where there might be some mystery to the actualization of the potentials in the unqualified absolute. The other way is from the deity perspective. There's a facet of deity that's the other side of the unqualified absolute, the infinite capacity. Deity functions, right? Right, and has to be taken into account, right? That functioning. So that's another way to, for those of you who have learned a little bit more about deity, that's kind of a more immediate, understandable way to, remember, we saw the same thing way, way back when we talked about the Isle of Paradise and the relationship of the unqualified absolute to the Isle of Paradise, and they would actually throw in the word function, right? And I was like, wait a minute, a reservoir of potential doesn't function. Oh, they're talking about the facet of deity. They're talking about the infinite capacity.
In this context, yeah. They're just saying it's unpredictable in comparison.
Right. I mean, no one can write down the physics of, you know, functioning of an infinite facet of deity, right?
I love it when they throw things.
Right.
It brought up to mind to me that thing that they talk about water, that, you know, they say here, electrical and chemical reactions are predictable, where they say that if you took those hydrogen and oxygen, you wouldn't predict that it would create water. But it does. Maybe that's sort of the way I figured out, you know, the unqualified absolute can get you something out of something that you wouldn't think it would be.
And that's another way of just kind of appreciating the holistic fact that's there. It's not all just parts, right? Yeah. Okay, then they throw a little paragraph in here.
Pre-intelligent organisms react to environmental stimuli, but those organisms which are reactive to mind ministry can adjust and manipulate the environment itself.
Okay, so there you can see, I mean, by mind ministry, they mean adjutant mind ministry. You know, by pre-intelligent, they mean pre-adjutant, and it's just mechanical mind. But did you, not only do you learn, but to see, to throw in that addition, think about that difference between a plant and an animal, right? You know, even a rudimentary animal is distinguished from a plant because it manipulates the environment itself. It doesn't just sit there as a passive response to the environmental stimulus, right? The badger digs a hole in the ground, say. Modifies the environment, right? In a conscious, active way. So that's why they threw in just that one little tidbit to get you to reflect on that, how animals are can adjust and manipulate the environment itself, and you take that all the way to humans, right? You're supposed to bring in personality management into that. I mean, that's the whole point, is getting to the point where you have someone who can definitively and in eternity effectively, absolutely adjust and manipulate the environment. We've talked about that. You know, getting the world to light and life isn't turning us all into plants where we just passively are subject to whatever fancy environment is in a world that's enlightened life, and you're feeling it, right, and having joy in its presence. No, you are dominant. You know, that's when the earth is fully in the hands of beings. Okay, the whole point of this mind is to that end. Okay, then the final little paragraph here.
The physical brain with its associated nervous system possesses innate capacity for response to mind ministry, just as the developing mind of a personality possesses a certain innate capacity for spirit receptivity, and therefore contains the potentials of spiritual progress and attainment. Intellectual, social, moral, and spiritual evolution are dependent on the mind ministry of the seven adjutant spirits and their superphysical associates.
Just quickly, that superphysical associates at the end there, one thing they just mean is you have a mind ministry in a local universe, for instance, besides just adjutant mind ministry. You have Maranja mind ministry and other mind ministry. That's also superphysical. And you can see that when you start the next section, referring to that. But you also have the Holy Spirit, Spirit of Truth, etc. Okay, those are associates also. Especially as you get up to the sixth and seventh adjutants, the Holy Spirit starts to become an associate to those mind ministries. Okay, so that's again, notice how they're pointing out that you've got to have this whole system. The mind is dependent upon the matter. The spirit is dependent upon the mind. You can't just have all sorts of fancy spiritual evolution without considering the details of even the first adjutant. Right? After all, that's the whole point of using those designations, spirit of something for the adjutants, instead of just energy of something, is to remind you that in the fullness of a spiritual nature, you're using all seven adjutants, right, in a spiritualized mode. Okay, so, hence their statement there, that intellectual, social, moral, and spiritual evolution are dependent on the mind ministry. And then the other element there in the beginning, where you have the mind related to the matter, you've got that twofoldness. But don't forget, as a student of the fifth epical revelation, the things that the other element that humans have never included in their thinking. Right? The spirit-mind interface. Right? As they say there, just as the developing mind of a personality possesses a certain innate capacity for spirit receptivity, right, and therefore contains the potentials of spiritual progress and attainment, and that, again, that's related to that whole what Jesus did 2,000 years ago. God is spirit. He's not your material father; he's your spiritual father. To try to get you to above that mode of thinking that your free will is about mind over matter, that God, is about the arrangement of molecules and your feelings about those arrangements, to get above that and to discover that which humans have never appreciated, that genuine free will is about personality taking a hold of the spirit influence upon the mind and directing the mind to do something unnatural. And has nothing to do immediately with matter at all. Right? That's your free will. That's what a religionist is. A religionist is not someone who does curious things with matter that the run-of-the-mill person doesn't do. A religionist is something that is someone who uses spirit to do something uncommon, unnatural with the mind, to take control of the stimulus response, to respond unnaturally to a negative stimulus, right, specifically, to respond positively, to choose to respond positively to a negative stimulus. That's a religionist. And you can't see that, by looking at matter. You can get indirect evidence of that by looking at the matter, but to just recognize that fundamentally the religionist is not visible. It involves two energies that we can't kick or poke. Spirit energy and mind energy. And that relationship is what makes you a religionist.
What was the
expression you said?
Spirit energy and mind energy. Right? It's those other two energies that you can't see, touch, taste, feel, whatever. That's what Jesus, in very simple terms, was trying to tell them 2,000 years ago. To start, you're turning your attention towards that other interface. Don't worry so much about rearranging the molecules so that they give you more pleasant experiences. You know, don't get so fixated on that. Arranging the money molecules so that you have more pleasant experiences, or you know, or whatever it is. Right? That's fancy animal desires. And the only way to actualize your human potentials is in that spirit-mind interface, not in the mind-matter interface. Okay. And it just keeps chugging and chugging. Let's see, I suppose, yeah, hey, next time we'll be wrapping up here the evolution. They've got some more details. You can see they're actually going to focus more directly on the mind here in this next section. If it wasn't obvious already that's what this overcontrol was about. All right, let's take a moment, everyone.